This is an intro to an intro because we have a very important disclaimer.
Yes, we are coming to you today with an errant public service announcement, namely that we've made a big decision about our recording process, and we have decided that we want to stay true to our original errant idea of having a raw, unscripted podcast, and we will now no longer be editing any of our episodes.
So we decided this after we recorded this episode, and you'll hear in the episode that we clearly think we're still going to edit it, which we never did. And so it's a sneaky view into how we would normally say cut, edit, and sometimes sculpt the conversation until it's like a beautiful piece of rounded off text. But we realize that this is not really how our conversations happen. So we're going to just have a phone call between Jana and me every now and again, and you'll hear dogs and vacuum cleaners and us talking in Afrikaans a lot more than before.
Yeah, like sometimes we say something and we are insecure about it, or we don't know. We're like, should we say it? Should we not? Or we have an idea and then we start talking and then we're like, no, this is shit. Let's stop. Let's do something else. So this episode, you will hear a bit more about that. And then, yeah, so we've decided to embrace it. We are curious to hear how you will receive it. And another disclaimer about this particular episode is that we kind of had to end very abruptly because Nicoline had another engagement, and we initially thought we would add some more and still say all the things we wanted to say, but now we decided we were just going to leave it as it is, unfinished, unfiltered, and we might air out some of these ideas in later episodes again. But for now, we hope you enjoy this new Erit product.
I'm Nicoline Berger
And I'm Jana Vosloo,
and this is Erit. Good morning, Jana.
Morning, Nicoline.
It's been a long time since we recorded.
Yeah, it feels like an old muscle that we need to retrain and flex now. I mean, how long has it been since we've recorded an episode, just the two of us?
Sure, months, months, like last year. But also, if our audience, if they don't follow us on Instagram or get our newsletter, which, by the way, you should subscribe for, because every now and again we send out a little love letter. You won't know that Jana and I have completely embraced the organic nature of this collaboration and this project. We tried for a while to kind of push it into a business strategy and then realized that it was always meant to be something that just adds to our friendship and grows in its own way without us pushing too much or making it too much of an effort. So we're dropping in with Erit episode, we don't know what, and it doesn't matter what season. And you're welcome to have a little Erit surprise. Yeah,
I think, Nicoline, maybe even we can give a small update on like where we are at now since we've last recorded, before we get into today's topic.
Let's make that question just a little bit more specific, because you know I can talk for hours about my life. Are you talking art? Are you talking profession? Are you talking Erit? Like what am
okay,
I giving
true.
People?
Let's do a quick personal update, which for you will obviously be art and, you know, how it's all linked together.
Yeah, so I think I could link it also to Erit in the sense that from the collaboration with Jana and Margot, who's also part of our Erit team, I've learned a lot, and we are hoping to in the future share a conversation about podcasting and starting a podcast. But mainly on the theme of collaboration, I've learned so much from this project and have started focusing more and more on my coaching work. So
I'm working a lot with creatives that are blocked or that need more clarity in their way that they work or how they present themselves to the world and how to kind of bring business and art together, as I feel like I'm quite good at communication. So I'm helping artists to communicate to the world, and it's really, and also to communicate better with their inner artists, to be more compassionate and to kind of create a sustainable way of practicing art as a profession. So that's taken up a lot of my time. I'm doing some free musing sessions at the Commons in Musenberg, which is basically like a support group that I'm running for any creatives or anyone that considers themselves interested in creativity or want to expand in that. And it's kind of my, a little bit selfish community service, in the sense that it is free and it is for the community, but I'm also learning a lot about how the creative mind works and also getting a lot of resources and inspiration from these sessions. Then I'm doing an exhibition soon at the Commons as well on the 1st of June. It's opening, and I'm also working on a project that brings back my performance art, which we discussed quite a bit in the first season of Air It. There was an episode where we spoke about Flight, the performance I did with The Staircase, and that performance is now being changed and kind of continuing, and I'm going to present it in Spain at a conference. So that's quite exciting. I'm still trying to get to Spain physically, but either way, I'm contributing virtually or physically. Yeah, thinking about race and sexuality and my identity and my culture a lot at the moment in my art. That's kind of the... And oh, one more thing I want to mention, because this is a very inspiring thing. Jana and I have also changed our... Not changed, but added to our relationship in creating what we call accountability sessions. And we are actively exchanging in a form of a quote-unquote creative coaching, where I'm helping Jana write her PhD in some ways, and Jana's helping me write a lot of the content around the new work that I'm creating. And so we're meeting once a week, and we have a structure that we've created for ourselves. So yeah, learning a lot about working together and how that is the way to kind of organically, and maybe also more in line with the feminine energy, you know, like more kind of organic and flowy and creative and interconnected, we can work on projects together.
Nicolene, you've been busy. So, I mean, yeah, just so that I think it's good just for Erit listeners to also get a bit of a sense of, you know, what you've been busy on with behind the scenes. It's very public on your Instagram page, but yeah, it's been super inspiring. And the place where we've started meeting up is at the Norval Foundation in Steenberg, Tukai area. So if you are in Cape Town, like, it's such a good space to just get a year ticket if you're also an art lover. And we just sit in their restaurant and drink coffee and work together. So yeah, that's been a very fun part of our other side of our collaboration beyond Erit.
Definitely.
For me, I used to work in the ed tech scene with designing online short courses full time, which was a lot of also research and writing about on very like obscure themes that I learned a lot from, like something about this podcasting process of, you know, taking a random topic and quickly researching and putting something out and then moving on. Like, a lot of that resonated with my previous role as a learning designer, and I worked on, you know, courses about sales management and AI and pharma and all these things. But after a while, I decided I'd prefer focusing on the content that inspire me a bit more. So I decided to quit my job and pursue a PhD full time. I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before, but so that was like after in the beginning of April, I started with that. And now I've transitioned into being a full-time student again and really, kind of finding my feet with academia and academic writing and researching again. And I've recently also presented a paper at an international conference from my master's work still. And
yeah, it's just really fun to have this time and energy and space to think about the topic that really interests me and that I'll share more about a bit later. But anyway, okay, that's our update.
Well, that's stunning. We must definitely do a podcast episode about your PhD topic because it's fascinating and it also actually crosses a lot with the work that I'm doing right now, even more so the conference in Spain, which is also about walking. So
yeah, no, we have a lot of
teaser there
overlap that we can still bring to Erit as well.
Constant influences in each other's lives.
Okay, so
today we're doing a kind of exposing topic, I suppose, if you can call it that, in the sense that it is quite a sensitive topic and we want to talk about it because from our context as white Afrikaans women, there's very specific kind of structure around this conversation, the talk.
Today we are airing out the talk, and you can probably guess by this time now that we are talking about sex. And just
even
context,
saying that is like, you know, we're joking now with the way that we introduce it. This is actually it, you know. It's like saying the word sex, you know.
Sex. Nicolene, do you have a moment to sit down and talk about sex?
I am seated, Jana. I'm ready.
So, and we've literally been, this topic has kind of been on the back burner for a long time. We've been wanting to talk about it, and we've seen a lot of the shows that we've watched and podcasts that we've listened to and books that we've read have just kind of all really related to this topic recently. So while all of that is still semi-fresh in our minds, we thought like today is just the day. And I think we should start with the beginning, how we were introduced to the topic of sex. And Nicolene, maybe you can start by telling me a bit more about your experiences. Let's go back to those
even
childhood memories.
So the first thing I want to say is that although we might share some personal stories, we'll see how the conversation goes and how we feel personally with boundaries of sharing about our intimate lives. This conversation is not about the act of sex and how we are practicing it and in our personal lives and that kind of detail. It's more about the conversation about sex and the difficulty about talking around sex. So it's a conversation about a conversation in the sense, and obviously, hopefully we'll go a little bit deeper into the actual conversation, maybe, let's see. So some of the things that I want to air out around the messaging that I received around sex relates to the church, specifically the Ingeet church, and then the talk with mom and dad about the birds and bees, and then also public school talks and sex education. And then maybe also a little bit about, you know, when puberty strikes, and now as an adult reflecting on the misconceptions I had about sex and sexuality back then. So the first story I wanted to tell was in Bible school, which after church, people that are active in the church, adults, could just kind of volunteer to have these classes with us after school, which is also a whole interesting topic because anyone who is like a, what's a decan? Is it a decan?
Deacon,
or, you know, like a leader in the church. Yeah. There's some of these people are just very involved, and then most of them are actually middle age, and most of them were also male, and of course in the Ingeet church, Afrikaans white people. So there was this old bally, maybe in his 50s, that around grade 10, I think, had to have the conversation with us about sex, and his daughter was in my class. She was one of my best friends at school. So it was quite interesting to afterwards then hear the nervousness from her side to be in a class where her dad talks about sex with other children or people, young people. And he drew this diagram, and it was all about choices. So he kind of like first of all, made the topic very softer by, you know, saying, okay, it's not a topic about sex, it's about choices. So that's the kind of how he introduced the theme. And then in Afrikaans, you call it gemeenskap. I don't know if the English word is communion, surely not. What is
it? That's like nachmal.
Oh yes, that's nachmal.
but I, yeah, that gemeenskap, biblical term.
It's a biblical term
also
for
recall
sex.
Finding yeah. it so hilarious, yeah.
Because, so the word sex is not really used. It's called gemeenskap, or it's like when a man and
like
a woman
coitus.
Joined.
Isn't it coitus? Coitus. Oh, is that the right word? Now that sounds like...
That word. Sounds worse than sex to me now.
It does.
Okay. Something that happens in the koi. Coitus. So also he used this word gemeenskap, or they'll say like when a man and woman loves each other in the eyes of God and come together in the act of love, you know, like kind of all the words you could possibly use to not say the word sex. And then he drew this diagram of choices and first started with like drugs, choose to do drugs, choose to not do drugs. And then kind of almost the worst one was like sex, where choose to have sex outside of marriage. And then the diagram on the right was like the happy one. So choose to have sex within the marriage. And then the arrow goes down and he drew these little pictures. And then it said like affirmation and approval in the eyes of God getting married. And then the next one was like love and safety and security. And then the next one was like white picket fence, get a baby, happy family, die and happy, you know, and happily ever after. And then the side on the left was like choose to have sex outside of marriage. And then it went to heartbreak, unsafety, insecurity, sexually transmitted diseases. Then you somehow have AIDS, and now you're sad you have AIDS. So then you somehow start doing drugs, and you somehow start drinking, and then you die, you know. So it was like just this like doomsday downhill. And I even remember at the end he like drew this little gravestone with a sad face on.
My word.
Yeah. So that was what I got from the church. And yeah, and then I don't know if you want to also maybe tell a church story before I go on to the next category.
Yeah, I mean, that story, Nicolene, is, I mean, there's something very funny about it, and then there's something very sad about it as well, that like those extremes of like literally like happiness / fulfillment / death and everything bad. Yeah. And those kind of that type of binary thinking about sex. I don't know, like I'm when I think about the church and sex, definitely that whole, heteronormative thing of like when a man loves a woman, and also the fact that sex is always like God is in a way always present in it. So it's something almost beyond yourself in a way, like there's no personal stake in it beyond just the choice to do it or not. And then I also think about, and I guess this goes more into the schooling in the teenage year, where in terms of church it was more like, you know, grade 11, that type of time when they talk about what's the word, bekering, like the kind of giving your life to God or whatever.
I can't recall the correct word now.
But I just remember also a story of how girls, especially because I was in an all-girls school, were kind of told that like they had to admit by that age whether they've had sex or not in order to be able to fully give themselves to God. And just that public shaming of having to do that in front of your peers. And it's like, if you do it, if you say that you've done it, then there will be forgiveness. And then, so that's a bit more intense, I guess, but the messaging still always is similar to like perhaps basically being either shamed for sex, and then this like very vague fantasy, very vague reality of what this beautiful act of sex could look like. It's always like that disclaimer of like, dit kan ietsie baie mooi wees wanneer mense lief is vir mekaar, dan is dit wonderlik, you know. Then it's amazing when two people love each other, but in all other circumstances, it's just horrible. Like, let's not talk about that, like how it works when it's amazing. Let's just talk about why you should avoid it. And
The other thing I'm also thinking about now is how in that time when we had that conversation, it was also grade 10, grade 11 in the Bible school, we were also doing voortplanting in biology. What is that again in English? What's wrong with our English today?
Flip it, man.
Well, anyway, when you create babies, you're the biology of creating babies. Please send on our Instagram all these words we couldn't translate today. But we were also talking about that at the same time, which was also almost very, I want to say, aestheticized or that cleansed in the sense where they're trying so hard in school for the content not to be sexualized. Even though we are talking about penises and vaginas, there's like all these illustrations and it's just about the mechanics of it. There's nothing about, you know, again, like you say, the actual act of it and the emotionality of it. And so you have the physicality and the emotionality and all of that come together in this act of intimacy. And what I remember feeling was also because, of course, the biology lessons on voortplanting and the Bible school
reproduction.
So reproduction and the Bible school lessons were all kind of timed for the time where you become sexually more aware because you're going through puberty. So now you had your extremely awkward, crazy phases in grade 8 and 9 where there's no way that you can talk about sex in any context with boys that age because they just like make jokes and laugh and it's just too silly and the girls blush and they can't actually take any of the shame and the content in. Where then they wait kind of until grade 10 and 11 and then share this content with you. But I remember feeling a massive amount of guilt and shame because of course I was sexually curious and had boyfriends and, you know, had all these feelings and desires. And then everything I just heard from every corner was it's not safe. Either it's not safe in the sense that you're going to get sick and die, or it's not safe because your heart is going to be broken and you're never going to be the same, which is a story I'll tell just now. There was a very funny illustration of that at school as well. And then from the church, like, it's shameful, you're going to go to hell. So having all of these puberty feelings and this confusion of your identity and how it links to your sexuality and the sexual expression and identity and all of the stuff that just kind of like this hot pot in high school is also the time where they lay on this hectic shame and guilt, which made me feel extremely confused and actually at some stage really emotionally unstable because I was going through this whole clash between my religious orientation and beliefs and my sexual feelings and desires to explore and express. So that's also interesting to think about that time, you know?
Yeah, I think to add to that, definitely I resonate so much with what you said. And it's almost like just how that, even the curriculum on sex education just happened so late and how shame, because I think people, you forget almost how early on, how young you are when you start kind of questioning or exploring your own sexuality. Siri just wanted to ask me something. Never mind then also if I'm thinking about people who are confused about their sexual, or not confused, but who are grappling with their sexual orientation because everything is just all of these, you know, everything we've said thus far is very much a man and a woman. So like just imagining how, you know, how that experience in this, like all these layers must also be. But I also remember like grade 4, grade 5, like on the rugby field, all these boys like asking questions to girls about like, have they masturbated? And then all the girls was like, no, never, you gross. And all the boys are like, almost like have that permission slipped already, like kind of brag and talk about that. So just also I recall from how like young children are when they start talking to each other about sex and all things related to sex, and then how late that kind of curriculum addresses that.
And there's always one kid that is like a little bit more less sheltered, I suppose, even in the sense that their parents maybe talk to them more openly, or they have an older brother or cousins that have given them some also sometimes misguided information, but they have more information. And then they kind of just start sharing it on the school ground. And it's really funny because in a way I was one of them, not because I had more information, but my mom had this book on giving birth. And I found it, and I like saw a fully grown woman's vagina up close for the first time in my life in that book, and was of course very fascinated by it because it's so like covered up, and I didn't really see, you know, like adult vaginas in that way, because the pictures were really like fully frontal of the vagina, and then as the baby comes out, and I was like, I think I was 5 years old and I found this book and I was really fascinated by it. And then my mom caught me showing all my little girlfriends that came to visit one day. We were like sitting and paging through a book, being very curious about it. And then maybe also a little bit exploring our own bodies. and was quite like scared about that because she didn't want me to have the reputation as the child that was sharing information about sex at that age, even though it wasn't sex, it was just actually the female body. And also to think about how we are sheltered even, you know, from that, how girls, I heard a family of ours, I have a little niece and she's like, I think also 4 or 5 now. And when I want to go to the bathroom and we're drawing or playing whatever, and I'm like, I want to go to the bathroom. She's like, can I come with you? And then I said yes, and she was so surprised. And then she told me, like, you know, I'm gonna say it enough, so I'll repeat it in English. But she went like, little, you know, and klein meisies, mag saam met ander meisies in die badkamer ingaan, want meisies mag vir meisies sien, maar seentjies mag nie vir meisies sien nie. En net booties en sissies, net booties en sissies mag mekaar sien. So dis okay as ons saam ingaan. So she was like, girls can see each other naked, but boys are not allowed to see girls except if they're a brother and sister, and that kind of conditioning about nudity. And also then when we went into the bathroom and I, you know, sat down to pee, like her curiosity and kind of like how she wants to look, but she's been trained also not to look, and that kind of raw curiosity about sexuality and the body and yeah, it was also very interesting.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, yeah, I also recall exactly that same, like. And, you know, I can recall as a child that experience of like looking at a more mature woman, or like if it's even if it's your mother or whatever, and then between peers and, you know, that whole relationship.
Yeah. Another story that's coming up. Sorry, I'm airing a lot now, but it's, there's so much coming up.
That's why we're here.
Yeah. So I think also something else that I quickly want to say, I'll tell you about the sexual education that we got in primary school and how it links to this other story of a young boy that I was recently in a conversation with. It was so funny, where I was in grade 4, grade 3, quite young, and someone came to talk to us about sex. And it wasn't supposed to be in a religious context, but the school had a Christian background. So, of course, the speaker they got had some moral bias in that sense, where they then shared that having sex, unprotected sex or sex out of marriage or sex, like unsafe sex, essentially, which was immediately classified also as sex outside of marriage. They stuck two pages together with Prit. And then as they spoke about sexually transmitted diseases, let these papers dry. And then at the end of the talk, tore the pages apart and then had the one thing that, you know, pieces of the page were stuck to the other page and said that this is how it is when you have unsafe sex and sex outside of marriage. And what was fascinating about that conversation was that the boys and the girls were split. So that was the conversation we received from an older lady talking about her own experiences of having sex outside of marriage and you know, like how it kind of ruined her life and everything. And then this very almost violent illustration of how you are not whole after having sex outside of marriage. And then when we asked the boys what they spoke about, I can't remember the exact details, but it was basically about how masturbation is normal and how there's like parameters within there, how where they're allowed to explore their bodies and not. where the girls got the talk about the paper being torn apart. So that was also fascinating. But then on the other side, I heard a story the other day. I was in the presence also of a young boy with his family, and he knows me really well. So we were driving somewhere and he was with his grandma, and they have a really lovely relationship where he asks a lot of his like intimate questions to his grandmother because she answers him with more truth, where his parents are maybe also a little bit scared to give him too much information, and then he becomes the smart one at school. So he was telling his grandmother, like very nervously asking her if it's true that if you masturbate too much, you turn blind. And she was like, what? Mm-hmm. And then he said, no, it's most true that you go blind. And then she's like, no, it's not true. And then he said, well, he did learn. He knows that it's true that if you masturbate too much, you're kind of like wasting your semen and you can't have children when you're older. So all these like misinterpreted stories and his anxiety, because he's 12 now, so his anxiety about the desires and the very natural feelings that he has, and then the information that he's getting, and kind of the spaces where he feels comfortable to talk about it, so not with his parents but with his grandparents, because they have an open relationship. And it took quite some time for him to actually get to what he wanted to ask. He was really nervous, and he said he wanted to drive in the car alone with us, so not with his little sister. And then the whole way he was like kind of working up to asking this question, like, you know, like little boys, like, I want to ask a question. No, I don't want to ask a question. I don't want to question. Don't laugh at me. You know, like this kind of defensive nervousness, almost emotional, because he's so scared of what if it's true. And he's obviously going through his own puberty and development now. So that's also very interesting to see how damaging these kind of not even sex education, you know, like actually just threats under the guise of sex education can be.
Yeah, like the fear mongering that goes on. And yeah, when you were speaking, I was also thinking about a story that I was told and that I believed that of. And yeah, that is also a very religious idea, I guess, that every time a woman has sex with someone, a piece of her goes missing. And so that if you have sex with too many people, then there's nothing of yourself that will remain. And that kind of idea in terms of casual sex or unprotected sex, so that there's one thing just to have sex and whatever, but then also if you have sex with people, have sex with multiple partners, and that also comes to the whole conversation about slut shaming, mm-hmm. I guess, and just how, you know, the I guess the gender divisions between and that's like a whole other phase, even in university or later on, with like this girl kissed two guys in the same night, or you know, what kind of damaging soul is happening now because you gave so much of yourself away, which is just such a intense way to think about it. So definitely I think what we are getting at, and what like talking about these childhood memories is reminding me of, is just how much is at stake when we have a conversation about sex, and how much, you know, how all these, I guess there's also a part where the people who have to have the conversations are not equipped, and it's almost such a generational thing.
I remember that I wanted to talk about the talk with my parents, the birds and the bees, because I think it also exposes some interesting things. When you said now this generational thing, I think that when I reflected about the conversation we had, and also the things they've said about families that are maybe more open with sex towards their children, or allow their children more freedoms, for example, like boys were never allowed in my room alone and things like that, where some of my other friends in primary school and high school, their parents were more flexible with those rules. There was this conception, or still is maybe, with my parents, that if you give too much information about the actual act of sex, that you then seem to be encouraging, you know, so that kind of mystery around what actually happens is also in a way kind of weaponized as you need to be afraid of it, or you need to be careful around it because you don't know what to expect. And what actually happened when my mom and dad decided to have the talk with me, which was when I had my first boyfriend, I think around 14, we were walking in town, and I remember my dad being really awkward. And all they kind of wanted me to ask any questions, but because of all the fear and the shame created when I was younger during all these other institutions, I didn't feel the freedom to ask practical questions about having sex, like how does it actually work or anything like that. And they also just mainly spoke about the love and the sacredness of it, which the sacredness of it, I agree on, you know, it can be sacred and it can be really beautiful, but it's not, in my experience, so conditional and connected to certain choices that you make. It's basically just if you share that moment of intimacy and you hold it in like a precious regard, then it's sacred and special. But it can also be casual and fun and just pleasurable or whatever. You know, there's all these other options, but they mainly focus on the sacredness of it and the love of it and how their relationship is successful because they waited until after marriage and, you know, all of that stuff. But what was created then in that gap between the morality of having sex and how much was connected and communicated around that, and then the danger of getting pregnant and the sexually transmitted diseases, and then actually becoming sexually active, was that in that high school and university phase where you're now actually exposed to more practical truths, either through your friends or, you know, most people go to porn or start searching, whatever, and you find some information, is that when you actually then engage in the act of having sex, there's so much of it that you don't understand. And then a lot of the sources, like, for example, porn, but also, like, I don't know, FHM magazines, or what is the Cosmopolitan?
Even, you know? Like, when you were younger, like 17 and girl, yes. They also had, like, that was a major resource, I remember.
Yeah, for me too. And the conversations or the articles in those magazines, the problems around them is that they also have their own political underpinning, in terms of like the assumptions around sex and the people that read it, and kind of heteronormative ways of setting up acts of intimacy and sex, but also they kind of simplify it for entertainment, you know, for instant gratification, yeah. So that you'll have a diagram of knowing whether your partner is sexually interested in you or not, and you'd follow those diagrams, those questions, you know, or
yeah, like a quiz.
Yes,
basically.
Exactly. And I'm just thinking now about this idea of foreplay and how foreplay in those magazines created this idea in me that foreplay is a woman's thing. I believed this for a long time until I actually started finding other sources and also experiences in my life where I'm like, okay, no, it's not. And also the almost damaging aspect of having a separate word for pleasuring a woman than sex, because that creates the idea that sex is only penetration, but sex is actually everything involved before the act of intimacy, is what I learned now, like from sources like Esther Perel, which I'll speak a little bit about more later, because she's an amazing, amazing sex therapist. But this idea that foreplay is only for women and only done like, and that there's also a time, you know, like 20 minutes foreplay and then sex, and it kind of separates the act of intimacy and like all these different sections, and doesn't acknowledge that there can be a dynamic relationship between what it is that you want and need, and that it's not always consistent, you know, like that one day you might want, and I'm calling it foreplay now because most of us know, but you might want like an extended sexual experience, and other times you might want to have like a short animalistic crazy I don't know if we're censoring ourselves, but fucking, you know, so like there's, you know, there's dynamic way of wanting and desiring, because as people we are dynamic, you know, and we can want different things in our lives, but there is this idea that, you know, military style, I don't know what.
No, I completely agree with what you said, and like on that part, just on the what you said earlier about moralizing element of, like, you know, in all of these things it was pitched as either it's not neutral facts, you know. It's like when this and this happens, it's bad in this way or whatever. There's always these kind of underlying moral judgments. And I think that's something we can also come back to when we, in talking about how it's sex is politicized, but then also on this kind of binary thinking when it comes to sex, or this, like, it's either this or that, or it's this category, you know, like you said, with it's foreplay and then it's sex. Also the same with oral sex. Like, mm-hmm. I remember like not being very confused and not understanding anything beyond heterosexual sex, straight sex, because if foreplay, you know, that whole thing of like, if oral sex isn't really sex, then how, you know, those type of questions, mm-hmm. I remember having them and not really finding, you know, well-researched answers to them. Mm-hmm. Same with like what an orgasm looks like. And that's also, it comes to also the type of representations we see in, mm-hmm. in popular culture, in films, where the, you said earlier, like the recipe for sex, mm-hmm. is very much like repeated all over, mm-hmm. Where you kind of see this, like,
yeah,
you know, this kind of 5-6 step, mm-hmm. Experience that's being portrayed as what pleasurable sex looks like.
Exactly. And then also that kind of recipe creates destructive ideas around how quickly it happens, or how orgasm is the ultimate point for sex, which in the kind of community that I live in now, I live with tantricas, and don't just Google tantra. It's the representation.
I was about to ask, can you explain to me what you mean by tantra or tantric?
Yeah, so I think we'll have to have a conversation at some point, rather with Olivia, about the, because I've forgotten now the exact lineage that she studies in, but essentially tantra that my housemate does or believes in or practices is a specific lineage that believes that expression and expansion of the spirit happens through sexuality, and that the sexual act or I wonder if I want to open this can of worms. I'm not gonna, so I'm just gonna start that sentence again.
That's all good.
So in the
note to editor Nicolene and Jana.
And so in the community that I am in now, and with the research that I've done with regards to the, like, for example, Esther Perel is a big influence in my life, you also realize later in your life that this over exaggeration or emphasis on orgasm is also quite destructive in the boundaries and relationships between partners. And I think this is where I kind of want to go now, where you said like the representation in media and in movies. I'm going to talk about Pen 15 now. So it's Pen 15, so it looks like how you would write penis in primary school and high school. And it's this absolutely hilarious comedy that I watched and then shared with Jana. Something's funny with the sound.
It's good on my side.
Okay. So it's still making like a little glitch. Anyway, so Jana also watched this series, and it's two comedians. They're in their 30s and they act like pubescent like teenagers, and it's hilarious because they expose a lot of the similar struggles that teenagers have in that phase of their life, and the misunderstandings around sex in puberty, and how if you're sheltered from it, like how much of it you're figuring out, with actually so much hurt and trauma along the way. And one thing that becomes clear in that series, because it's focused on two girls, is how desirability and value are connected to each other, and how how if you do not have certain experiences at a certain age, you are less quote unquote valuable, or you're not special, or, you know, it says something about who you are as a person if you do not experience things. And then actually the kind of pressure that teenagers put on themselves to get those experiences with all this like lack of information. And it's something that I really experienced in my own life as well. And how it relates to what I've learned and what I want to talk about a little bit later on the maintenance of relationships and the conversations around intimacy. Because besides the practical aspects of how to have nice, good, enjoyable sex and how it takes practice and how it's not just one act and then your specialness and your virginity is gone forever and that's it, you know, it's actually a process of learning and growing together with a partner or multiple partners in experiences and exploring your own body. That part is missing in our education, in my experience. But another part is actually the conversations around when you have that practice with someone or with multiple people, how to communicate with around intimacy and how to actually maintain a relationship is not actually taught to us at all.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think just the fact that so many people resonate with this idea of like, how do you communicate with your partner about sex? You know, all those type of questions is enough proof of that. Mm-hmm. Something that I that you mentioned now, just quickly on Pen 15, like I also watched it with my partner and we like absolutely loved it. And I just, it was such a, you know, just if I remember feeling like if I could only see this earlier in my mm-hmm. life. And yeah, so we just like 100% recommend it to 100%. All the Arid viewers. But you said something about how it relates to desirability and value. So in the show also where it's like something that if they don't take part in these experiences, like your first kiss or masturbation or whatever, that it somehow like either increases or decreases your value. Mm-hmm. And something that I want to share about as well is this book that I read recently in a reading group. It's kind of like a feminist reading group and it's semi-academic but also not really, like it's a philosopher who wrote the book and it's an academic book, but it's also very accessible and it's also a book that I can really recommend. And I just want to mention something about desire that I that this book really like illuminated for me, like a way of thinking about desire that I've never like really thought about before. So the philosopher who wrote this book is called Amiya Srinivasan, and the book is called The Right to Sex. And it deals with this, it deals with so many topics related to sex, so there's no way that I can explain or do it justice now, but it kind of starts from this point of departure of like, firstly, like who is there something like a right to sex, because it has this context of like certain men, especially on in the public and in the media in America, who has this idea, especially in like the college settings, of like they have the right to just kind of fuck whoever they want to. And the fact that a woman can say no or whatever is almost out of the question. So it moves from that idea of like, is there something like a right to sex, and then really, really complicated to like explaining the feminist debates, the internal feminist debates on sex, like on lesbianism, on abortion, on sex works, like all these themes that are like kind of typically discussed when you talk about sex. And then she has this thing about the politics of desire as well. And she questions, what is that? What kind of political or identity forces are at play when you talk about who you desire? I mean, just the idea that you can have a type. You know, people would say like, I'm only into blonde girls, or I can't date people from another race, or like I would never be able to be sexually attracted to someone with different physical abilities than me, or those type of very specific things that people talked about, who they desire, and then also who society deems desirable. So like the typical thing of like, you need to be skinny and you need to be preferably white and blonde, and even how all those fetishes and stuff operate with the conditions in which certain people are desirable and not desirable. You can also think about, for example, how Black women were historically portrayed as like hypersexualized and oversexualized, and almost that like what, yeah, there's a term also that they use in some like feminist philosophy texts about some women being called unrapable in quotation marks, like who so it's very intense, but I mean whose bodies are deemed desirable, and how historically and politically that have been constructed. So it's a long introduction now to this book, but I just really had to kind of interrogate my own thoughts about how my own desire came to be, and how to a large extent it's also not so innocent. And I think South Africa is a good example of that. If you think about the apartheid system, and we spoke about this in our episode of Dr. Azel Kutsia, where this whole law against sex with people of a different race is what upheld the apartheid system. So that whole thing about the white woman and the Black man, and having all these systems in place to keep them as far as possible away from each other, because then the whole apartheid and racial purity system would be dismantled. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just in terms of desire, there's that whole like innocent thing of like, what are my desires? What is the type of pleasure that I want? Mm-hmm. And then for me, it's that tension of like, how do you separate that from the way we've been conditioned to even think about desire in the first place? Mm-hmm. Yeah,
very, very interesting. And another thing that came up for me now, and it's similarly linked to desire, but more so to the value and the construction of the Afrikaner identity and the folk, you know, the nation that you just spoke about, and how virginity is actually the main thing that the white Afrikaans woman brings to the marriage in the exchange for security or financial support or whatever, is that kind of quote-unquote virtue of the Volksmoeder, and the overemphasis on you being quote-unquote pure. It's like all these horrible words, but before you go into marriage, because that purity or that virginity is what also secured the nation, or the construction of the nation, and kept bloodlines, you know, quote unquote, clear, and did all these terrible, terrible things. But how it's interesting that the woman's body, and I'm thinking a lot about this in my art at the moment, how the woman, the white Afrikaans woman's body, is almost sacrificed to this idea of the nation, and how that idea is still present in a post-apartheid, like very much present in a post-apartheid South Africa, where this overemphasis on your virginity and purity from the woman's side, and in my community, it's not so much focused on the male side, you know. And that is kind of the exchange that happens. Is, you know, I bring my body and promise you my sexuality, and almost this like sacrifice of my sexual autonomy to the institution of marriage, where and that's why how it's fascinating, the split where we spoke about the weddings, the bachelor parties and the bachelorette parties, and how they're so different in experience, in general, where that's almost like kind of the last moment of freedom for the male to go and, like, you know, see a stripper or get a lap dance, or, you know, do whatever they want to in that time, because it's kind of assumed that the man is sexually active or sexually more free, and how the woman is basically introduced to sex, quote unquote, for the first time at their bachelorette party. And I'm talking again now within our frame and within our context as white Afrikaans people, but that kind of innocence and emphasis on innocence from the woman's side, and how when I then went into a relationship, I didn't know how to speak about my needs and my boundaries, because it was never taught to me. Because I am actually in the value of the community and the culture, I am supposed to just sacrifice my body to the man in any way that he wants me, you know? And and not know how to even speak about what it is that I need, because if I speak about what I need, how do I know what I need? You know, you're not supposed to know what you need. You're not supposed to have any kind of sexual preferences, because that implies that you might have had sexual thoughts or sexual experiences outside of marriage. So kind of this almost performing innocence in some ways as well, that becomes part of the whole dynamic, because your value is connected to your innocence.
Exactly. And that is, I would say, also part of what the patriarchal project was about, and what kind of gave historically and at the moment still gives, and I'm not talking about like men maybe consciously doing it, but the whole system of how it still gives power to men in those type of contexts, whereas, you know, women typically have to, you know, there's that thing that, as you just said, about sacrifice and all these ridiculous demands that also, like, once you now get married and you do it and you make it, then you must also be a porn star and be able to like gratify him in all these ridiculous ways. So what Srinivasan also argues in her book is that because of this tension between like how we've been conditioned, and it's also through like capitalism in terms of how sex is being sold as a commodity, and how then women have to commodify their own bodies. Like, how do you like then, you know, marry this tension with this, like what we spoke about earlier, this like childhood curiosity, the your own fantasies, your own perception of your own desire, if you can't say that your desire is just like this innate pure thing, which is debatable, obviously. But then also like how, I'm also thinking about, so she says, because of all this, what we need in our sex education and everything is to try and work really hard at coming up with new ways of imagining sex. We need to, this is where we need to start being very, very creative. Yeah. And this is where we need to start coming up with new ideas and almost like rewiring ourselves in terms of what is really possible. And there's a few examples in her book where she also kind of reframes certain things. Like one thing that I read was like, she says, for instance, what if the envy you feel for another woman's body, her face, her charm, her ease, her brilliance, were not envy at all, but desire? So even the way we've been taught as women to think about, straight women to think about other women, or, you know, how that kind of what they call compulsory heterosexuality, where a lot of women also don't really grapple with their own sexual orientation fluidity. And the spectrum of like, you know, sexual fluidity and all of that. Like, maybe there's ways in which, you know, you've just the type of sexual suppression that is at play here, and like how you can maybe reframe it in fun ways. I find that a very powerful and helpful idea.
Interesting. And an interesting project also collectively, because I think, first of all, it's also to have the conversation more often. And because this is super public, we're not going into the details of our own personal sexual experiences. But I really, really value in my life that I have men and women that I'm comfortable with to talk about my sex life, in order to understand how they have different experiences and similar struggles. Something else that I want to mention that also needs to be debunked within this conversation of sexuality, and this is where Esther Perel comes in. So maybe I'll go on a little bit of an Esther rant now.
Tell us about, I mean, I think I've listened to one or two podcasts and maybe a TED talk that you recommended. But yeah. I mean, I feel like for you, Esther Perel is like what do you call it? It's like Mama Brown and Guru Perel or whatever.
Yeah.
So tell us, maybe tell our listeners, because you can maybe recommend the podcast, but tell her about just like who is Esther Perel and what you learned from her.
So first of all, I want to say, to link to what you just said about this project of creating a new way to understand and relate to sex, that something that has kind of been, we've spoken about it, but we haven't used the word, is something else that needs to be destabilized, is the assumed monogamy of how sex then takes place, you know. And Esther Perel she's a sex therapist and therapist, a relationship therapist, but she uses a lot of different kinds of therapy and very practical ways to kind of get couples to talk about sex and to kind of resolve their issues. And the way that I got to her was through her TED talk on cheating. She wrote a book, which I then read after listening to the TED talk, which is called Mating in Captivity, Eroticism in Long-Term Relationships. And that was her first big blow-up book, which she did a TED talk about, and then wrote a book, The State of Affairs, which was basically inspired by one chapter in Mating in Captivity about affairs and how we misunderstand affairs, and how the idea of marriage and monogamy is changing. And it relates a lot to the conversation we had about marriage at Erit as well, about like how our lives as modern people have changed, but the traditions of marriage are still very much grounded in our society. And monogamy is a way to also kind of, you know, force or pressurize sex into a certain way. And she basically exposes the complexities around sexuality within, you know, partnerships. But then, okay, so let me start here. One thing I wanted to say when we're thinking about the projects of thinking about sex in different ways is to make sex more complex than it is, like even more in the sense that sexuality and sex links to everything that we are, right? So we might think that sex and sexuality is just like separate and just starts, you know, like in your adult life, all of that. But children are also very sexual, and this is suppressed and denied, first of all. Second of all, your patterns in how you relate to people intimately, whether that is in a sexual relationship or intimately in friendships or, you know, any kind of relationship, intimacy has a lot to do with how you were raised and the kind of patterns and values that are conditioned into you when you're raised. And that this plays out in our sexual lives as well. So she kind of goes into this and talks to couples publicly on her podcast, which is called Where Should We Begin, about their lives. And it's sometimes she also has a podcast where she talks to business partners, and it relates very much to each other. The one is completely not about sex and the other one is very much focused on sex, but the conversations are very similar, because she says that we cannot deny the fundamental patterns of our lives and how we are in relationships when we have sex with people as well and not. Okay, I don't know if that makes sense. And then in this book called Mating in Captivity, she speaks about how there is an assumption that sex is supposed to be something spontaneous and natural. And she says this is a very destructive assumption, because it actually involves a lot of communication, a lot of learning, and a lot of practice, where partners tend to get to know each other over years. And then when they're more like older in their life, they might have a much better sex life than when they were younger, because of this communication and growing together. The flip side is also true, that in the beginning, the chemical attraction and the excitement and the risk of the relationship, because it's new, can create a spark. And then later in your life can dwindle down because you're not putting in the work. And then another interesting thing she talks about, which is what then led to this book, The State of Affairs, is she says that in our dominant culture, and she lives and works in America, but she, I think she's Belgian originally.
Yeah, she's Belgian.
Yes, and she speaks like 12 languages, and she works with couples from all over the world. But she speaks from this kind of almost the normative Hollywood construction, which we also have a lot of influence from. She speaks from like an American perspective, and she says that the idea that cheating is something that happens by accident or happens as a kind of malicious act that is meant to hurt, or, you know, that kind of could like breaks relationships apart, is also very damaging. And she talks about the third as always being present in a relationship. And I think this is where the fluidity comes in that you just alluded to, where our desire to maybe opposite sex or people that are not of our type, or, you know, something that's kind of outside of the partnership, if you're in a partnership, or this you know, your chosen sex partner. And she says that third person is always there. The third is kind of either the shadow of the third, which means that couples avoid talking about it, or it is inviting the third, where they invite the third in a creative way into their relationship to make their sexual life more exciting. Because she says what happens is that when we are in a secure relationship, the tension and the risk that's at the beginning of the relationship that fires on eroticism. And eroticism to her is literally just the aliveness, you know, the energy, the passion. It doesn't necessarily have to mean the act of sex, but you know, that physical pull that you have to each other is created by the risk of the relationship potentially coming to an end in the beginning phases. Now you decide that you're a couple, you're together, or you have a chosen sex partner. And in order for the security, you kind of ignore the idea that person can always leave you or can always disappear, and you make it safe, which then takes away the risk and the mystery and then dwindles down eroticism. So she says that you can use the idea of the third in creative ways by potentially sharing fantasies with your partner, if that's something that you agree on, or by potentially having more openness towards intimacy with friends, say, like you're allowed to hug and sit close to them or cuddle, or you see someone attractive and you share with your partner that you find them attractive and why. And this is all to kind of acknowledge that your partner is always a mystery and that you don't know them and that you have to constantly learn. But what it also involves is this larger conversation around what is allowed within our relationship, what is outside the boundaries of our relationships, how do we create safety and a container, and how do we create excitement and mystery. So this means that you have to have maintenance conversations where you have to have, she calls them negotiation meetings, where you meet with your partner and you negotiate your intimacy. You talk about what it is that makes you feel safe, what it is that you want to explore more, and what is your boundaries and how to move the boundaries, and acknowledge that you grow and change within the span of a lifetime. So, of course, coming across this theorist and this incredible writer, and she is brilliant and an amazing speaker, I wish I had this earlier in my life, because when I started, when I had my first relationship, I had no idea how to kind of fend for myself in relationship and how to show up to these negotiation meetings. And what the negotiation meetings then forces you to do is to go and sit and reflect on, like you said, your desire, your needs, how you act in the world and how you act in partnership. Yeah.
Ek moet net gou vinnig pause.
Okay.
Sorry.
Is okay, ek sal laaste stukkie van die ramble uitsny.
Ja, of kan jy onthou dalk wat die sin is om dit klaar te sê?
Nee. Maar is okay.
Ek iemand my naam hier by. Ja, ek dink ek kan maybe ek sal nog steeds wel respond op wat jy gesê het. Ek dink jy nou net op 'n bad time.
Ons het net om by te sê oor so 10-15 minute ontmoet ek en Dudu met mekaar. So ek weet nie of dit wat ek nou gesê het soos dra dit by tot die conversation.
Ja, dit doen baie. Ek wou net op dit respond as jy en toe skreeu met my naam Jana. So
wie was dit?
Dis 'n ou wat soos half goed hier in Ops verkoop en so, en ek het hom gister my kar laat was, maar toe gee ek hom R10 minder as wat ons gesê het, en toe wou hy net kom hoor of ek dit al het.
Okay.
Maar ek het dit nie.
Okay.
This whole idea, Nicoline, of Esther Brown, like if I'm understanding you correctly, it's like the third is, it doesn't have to be a literal third person, it's more this metaphorical idea of, you know, what is unsaid almost, like what remains unsaid between you, and as you said, this idea that I find it interesting that there's this mystery or mysterious
So sorry, just something else that's coming up with me that's actually the core point to this whole thing, okay. Is that what Esther Perel speaks about is basically that within the relationship, we never lose our sexual autonomy. We are always a sexually autonomous being, and we need to acknowledge that freedom that we have as a sexual being to make decisions for ourselves. So it's kind of the reverse conditioning of, as a woman, sacrificing your body to the marriage. It's the acknowledgement that there is an individual, and then there's a separate entity, which is the couple, which involves both of the individuals. But you basically are acknowledging and negotiating your individuality within the coupledom the entire time. So there is a sense of separation from the monogamous patterned idea that we have, and then this is this thing that we grow together. Rather, the couple is something separate from us as people, and it doesn't just involve us so that my needs becomes your needs. It's something that we actually have to talk about, and I find that very freeing, because as a woman and all of the conditioning and patterning we spoke about earlier, it forced me to then go and think about, who am I as an individual sexual being? What are my needs? What are my desires? And what are the spaces within my relationship that do not necessarily allow for some of the needs that I have? And how can I communicate about them?
Yeah, that's, I can see how that is like a big aha moment, yeah. You know, like,
yeah.
Because it's something that's just really denied or not mentioned. And as you said, it seems like Esther Perel gives a lot of practical tools for how to approach those conversations. And it would be interesting to also think about that in the context of people who are not in long-term relationships, or people who are maybe in relationships with multiple people, but yes, who have an actual third.
and she has, what's nice about her content is that all of the examples that she gives in her book, because it's about couples, is about people that are in relationships, but the relationships are not necessarily binary relationships or heterosexual relationships. And then in her podcasts, she has conversations with all kinds of people. So
yeah.
The sexual history kind of has to exist, except for when they're talking about business. But besides that, the openness and the fluidity and the different background, she really has a mix of people. Mariana, ons moet nou stop van do it nou net gejoin het ek gesien.
O, okay.
Maar ek het dan nog
gekeken. Dink jy ek kan vir vra dat ons net gou vir soos 'n minuut wrap up.
Yes, definitief, sy is vroeg. Want okay. Wat die ander ding wat ons kan doen is, ek weet nie of daar nog is wat jy wil sê nie, maar wat ek kan doen is ek kan die audio export, dit begin edit, dan kan ons dit terugluister en 'n outro record.
Ons kan dit ook doen. Ek is net bang dit gaan nou baie abruptly
eindig
met die Esther Perel. Maybe sê ek net gou een sin en dan doen ons dit.
Okay.
Ja, so I think basically having these different voices, like what I mentioned now of Serene Vasan and you mentioned of Esther Perel, what I'm getting from this is like these tools and to put into conversations ways of interrogating your own desire, how they came to be, realizing your autonomy, all of these matters kind of open up new ways of imagining sex and hopefully giving a more positive sexual education or experience to the next generations, and even to people like who are in their 50s and still being conflicted or exploring. So yeah, that's really fascinating. Thanks for sharing also your insights from Guru Perel.
Guru Perel. Please go listen, just even if to trigger yourself, go listen to her two TED Talks. It's really great.
Ek dink ons kan, daar gaan maybe nog goed wees wat ons wil sê of nie gesê het nie. So kom ons los dit net daar en dan kan ons altyd aanhou of record.
Yes.
Maar dis ek kan net soos in het in te jump.
Ja, en ek dink ek gaan ook jou, ek kan jou dalk net gou vinnig weer 'n voice call gee nadat ek en Dudu gepraat het, dat ons net soos debrief oor die conversation en besluit wat ons volgende wil doen en miskien record ons sommer die outro dan. Jy weet.
Okay. Dit klink goed.
Maar ek sal met jou incheck nene. Okay, leave okay. Manet. Bye.
Bye.
Erit is a team effort. It is produced by Nicoline Berger and Jana Vosloo. Morgan Leubscher contributes visually by creating beautiful artworks and social media content.
Tabu Krokom produced the intro and outro music, and reach out to us if you have an idea of how Erit can expand.
And remember, stay stimulated.